Welcome to the Towers Podcast. I'm Kate Tanula, and I am one of the editors-in-chief of this year's magazine. The Tower is the undergraduate art and literary magazine at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. The magazine is produced, published, and promoted all by students during a two-semester course. Every year, the Tower staff chooses a theme for the edition. This year, our theme is Asterisk. We chose Asterisk for its different functions across disciplines. It can be used to reference footnotes, mark a section break, and serve as a symbol for multiplication. Asterisks can be used in many ways, and this fluidity is at the heart of this year's theme. Our theme underscores that there is always more to uncover. We believe that the adaptability of asterisk lends itself to creating an inclusive space that supports the exploration of new and numerous approaches to life and storytelling. My co-editor-in-chief, Lawrence Lee, is going to talk a little bit about why we're listening to a podcast right now instead of hanging out at our annual launch party.
Hi, I'm Lawrence Lee. Usually we celebrate the publication of our magazine in April with a launch party at the Wiseman Art Museum. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, that party was canceled. With our entire campus shut down, our staff had to get creative to find a way we could celebrate this year's edition. Like the launch party, this podcast will feature both staff and artists. You'll hear contributors read from their writing and others discuss their work, as well as some of our editors talk about their experience being on staff and their personal favorites from this year's edition, all from a combination of this edition's art, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. To see featured art, please check out our art/artwords page at sites.google.com/umn.edu/thetower2020podcast. The Tower staff would also like to thank our professor and faculty advisor, Dr. Jim Selar. Without Dr. Selar's help, this magazine and podcast wouldn't be possible. Now let's hear a word from our genre chief.
Hey guys, my name is Riley and I am the chief art editor, a designer, and a publicist for The Tower. Working on the magazine this year has been a wonderful experience and I am so thankful for it. Over the past two semesters, the other art editors and I have worked hard to bring the best artwork to our audience. With that said, interpreting and analyzing art can be a tricky process. All art can mean something different to every viewer. Some art will ignite passion while others will provide comfort or understanding. With so many possible interpretations, it was nice to have a group of open-minded editors to work with. Our group had a mix of favorite mediums and styles, but we were focused on fresh art that reflects today's society. We may have gone back and forth a bit on certain decisions, but in the end, I think we managed to compile a pretty great collection of artwork. Art is an integral part of the magazine, so along with each genre episode, we will have some of our art editors and artists from this issue talk about some featured art. We've got a few artist talks from contributors Christian Hasdad, Taylor Roberts, and Kate Miller. You can view all of the artwork for yourself in our magazine or online at issue.com, where you can check out all of our past issues as well. There's a link to the site on our homepage. In this year's issue, I hope you are able to find a piece that speaks to you.
Hi, my name is Kate, and I am an editor-in-chief and art editor for this year's magazine. Being an art editor has been an incredible experience, and I am honored to have been able to be a part of it. I have always found a constancy in the power and potential of art. I love the back and forth, the push and pull of creating something beautiful. This year, we received many amazing pieces, and it has taught me that art can be many things. It is personal and it is universal. It heals and unites. Kate Miller's piece, The Trial, is illuminating in the way all great art is. It stood out to me for its use of medium and depiction of tension. The Trial is a lino-cut relief print of someone suspended, on the verge of falling. It has an intricacy and delicacy that makes the piece highly evocative, making you feel as if you are standing on the edge of something both great and terrifying. The contrast between this image of tension and anxiety and the precision required for this kind of medium is striking. Miller is an interdisciplinary multimedia artist studying art and management. Her art explores ideas surrounding community, womanhood, and breaking cycles of intergenerational trauma. Now, I am honored to introduce Kate Miller.
I have a fascination with the moment of absolute change in a narrative, the point of no return, of suspense, when the viewer is on the edge of their seat, wondering if the hero will succeed. Will they take control of their own fate? Will they let go of what's been holding them back? Will they grow? The trial is my first love letter to that defining moment where the hero stands on the precipice of change. On a less serious note, the trial is an inside joke with myself. It was my first venture into relief printmaking, and learning the new process was a trial in and of itself. It was a challenge of my technical skill to combine my passion for figure drawing with the new aspects of block carving and printing to put an image on paper. Now, months after this first foray, I've made many relief prints that are not about this moment of change. My larger body of work discusses community building, healing, intergenerational trauma, and women's rage. The steps involved in healing, grief, and living with anger are long and arduous, fitting for the similarly taxing process of relief printmaking. Drawing, carving, tearing paper, rolling ink out onto a block. The physicality of these processes is meditative. It allows me to feel the anger, the frustration, and the need for growth at the beginning stages while drawing and carving. After capturing those initial emotions in the design, I can then let them go throughout the rest of the steps. The layering of the emotional process of acknowledgement, action, and resolution with the process of printing is integral to my work.
Hello, hello. My name is Annie Zhang, and I am the Chief Fiction Editor and Marketing Director for The Tower. And before we get started, I have just a few short things to say here before I turn it over. Firstly, I am incredibly grateful to have had this opportunity to work as this year's Chief Fiction Editor. Not only did I get a chance to see the entire magazine process from the bottom up, but I got to work with our wonderful staff of fiction editors, Claire, Jacob, Shay, and Kimberly. Claire is one of our copy editors, and alongside Jacob, they are both designers as well as fiction editors, sewing together the finer parts of our magazine into a beautiful work of art. Take a look later if you can. Shay, in addition to being a fiction editor, is one of our online editors, keeping all your readers and listeners updated on the latest and greatest from our magazine on social media. Hashtag, what a gal. Kimberly, besides being both a fiction editor and artworks judge, is one of our publicists who you might have spotted pacing flyers down the hallway during a random venture to the vending machine, or was out chalking on a cold and windy day as you glanced down, curious, on your way to class. I am so honored to have worked with these amazing individuals this year, and I want to thank everybody who submitted their work to the Tower. It was an absolute pleasure reading through them all, and shortly you'll be hearing from a few contributors of this year's magazine who have agreed to join us on this podcast. Once again, it's been such a joy. Now, please hear a few words from my fiction editor and designer, Jacob.
Thanks, Annie. Hello, everyone. I'm Jake, and I'm a fiction editor and designer here at The Tower. It's funny, this year's edition of The Tower brings together some of the best in undergraduate fiction that has graced the pages of Midwestern student literature, which, as many of us Midwesterners know, is an often overlooked and underappreciated form of writing that provides an extremely heartfelt and emotional introspection that not many can top. I mean, what else are we supposed to do during the winters? Anyway, before I get carried away, all of these pieces were extraordinary, with myself having a particular affinity for Megan Lange's The Part in the Movie Where the Volume Gets Loud. Her story encapsulates the pure enjoyment and fun that fiction writing and the deeper meaning that can be supplanted in our minds long after we've finished reading them. Though, everyone should keep their eyes on all of our fiction writers in the future because they're all going to go places. Anywho, before I start rambling, let's hear a few thoughts from Shay.
Thanks, Annie and Jake, for those wonderful remarks. My name is Shay Kazima, and I'm a fiction editor and online editor for The Tower. This year, our fiction team began the acquisitions process with the goal in mind to publish new dialogues. We were particularly interested in pieces that made us question both ourselves and the unspoken rules around us. And I think it's fair to say that our contributors certainly succeeded in providing such narratives. From the delicate handling of words left unsaid between siblings in A Portrait of Shinjuku, to the humorous invisible observers in the part in the movie where the volume gets very loud, we feel that the fiction pieces in this year's edition of The Tower are an excellent representation of our theme, Asterisk. We're very proud to present fiction pieces that document the subversive and obscured perspectives which so often get pushed to the side of the larger narrative. And with all that said, I think it's time we hear from some of our amazing contributors. Here's Kimberly, a publicist and one of our fellow fiction editors who will be introducing the first reader.
Hello everyone, my name is Kimberly Zirin, and I'm a fiction editor, publicist, and artworks judge here at the Tower. The next reader you're going to be hearing from is Emily Hillman, who is a junior from Janesville, Wisconsin, majoring in global studies. Her top three bucket list items are to learn how to fly a plane, have a screenplay she wrote made into a movie, and become fluent in Arabic. Her piece Vandals follows two young men, Nash and Daniel, as they spray paint under a bridge. The unspoken tension, rich emotion, and enjoyable character dynamic are just some of the qualities that makes this piece shine. So without further ado, here's Emily.
Neither of them really cared about getting caught. At least Nash didn't, or so it seemed. Daniel tried to ignore the heavy feeling of his hands, the blue can of spray paint feeling even heavier. He tried to ignore the shakiness in his legs, bouncing on the balls of his feet. He gave Nash a side glance. Nash was examining their canvas with a discriminating eye. They were down on Oak, at the bridge that crosses the shallow part of the river. It was summer. The crickets chirped loudly, but hidden in the reeds, the frogs were even louder. Everything was dark around them, except for the single street lamp that stood at the corner of the road down the block, and the light of the waning moon that drifted in and out as the clouds moved east. Daniel watched Nash eye the abutment as if he were doing a maze with only his eyes, like he was constructing a tag before paint ever hit brick. Their canvas was certainly not blank. The chipping brick was covered in faded and overlapping words, some with sharp edges and multiple colors, some simple phrases done quickly and for political purpose, a few haphazard dicks here and there. It wasn't much of a gallery. People weren't likely to take notice or care about the things painted there. But it was tradition, Nash had said. At least it had been Nash and Alex's tradition before Nash and his mom lost him to a locked bathroom door in a Smith & Wesson. Daniel shifted from foot to foot and shook the can a little. Know what you want to paint? Nash didn't look at him, but squinted at the canvas and stroked his short beard. Not sure. Might just do my signature tag. He shrugged and began doing just that. Nash got to work, and Daniel looked down at the can in his own hand. Never had he done something this blatantly illegal. This was the first time he had seen someone do something like this without batting an eye. Nash was quite a bit shorter than Daniel, but he carried himself in a way that made him seem wizened with age unearned. He wasn't that much older, maybe 6 or so years, but his small eyes, beard, and the permanent lines on his face gave Daniel the impression that he had seen some things, even if he wasn't sure of what or how true that was. Nash had gone off to college, sure, and had gotten out of this little town, but Green Bay wasn't that far from here, and it's not even that big. Daniel said yes to this excursion after Nash had introduced himself at the arcade and they had played a few times on Daytona, USA, because he had the feeling that whatever it was Nash had seen in his life, he had to say it to someone. And somehow, Nash picked Daniel to say it to. Daniel wondered why and figured it had something to do with Alex, but the older guy hadn't mentioned him. Daniel only knew about Alex because he had been 2 years ahead of him in school. He'd been a real popular guy his junior year and was the talk of all the girls in Daniel's freshman class. He certainly made waves before and after he was gone. Daniel popped off the lid to his can of spray paint. He wasn't sure what was expected of him, but if he was going to vandalize public property, he was going to do it his way. In his drawing class, he had preferred drawing birds over anything else. The scarlet ibis was his current favorite. The long beak and existential eyes amused him. But more than that, Daniel admired the way the sun shone through the wings in the sky, pink and translucent. He could never get the wings just right, but who would care about a shoddily painted bird under a bridge in the middle of nowhere? It's just vandalism. Nash had done a base coat of an upside-down triangle in white, and, glancing at the kid out of the corner of his eye, made the split-second decision to alter his tag and began doing details in red. He watched the kid next to him fumble with this new medium. Alex had never fumbled. In fact, the first time they went, it had been Alex's idea. He must have been 13, 14. It had been just before he started high school, and Nash was about to head off to college. Nash smiled. He hadn't been so sure about all of this at that time either, but Alex had been elated. This was the first spot they marked up, but those unrefined works had been painted over and half-heartedly scrubbed away by the city parks department. Nash had spread a deck further underneath the bridge and was proud to see it was still there. Sure, there was a gang tag over one of the testicles, but the rest had stood the test of time. They tagged a bunch of places that summer, and the tradition continued every summer when Nash came back from college. Always, they'd start here, get the feel for doing something that could land them a night in jail, or at least a ride home in the back of a cop car. Although they were never caught, the thrill felt new that first night every summer. Through the years, they developed their own tags. Nash had pointed one out to Daniel when he picked him up earlier. The green and white tag was on the side of an abandoned elementary school building, next to his brother's red and white tag, but Nash had avoided mentioning the other tag at all, though it was similar in coloring and style. It was in this moment of reverie that Daniel stepped on an empty Corona can and about scared himself shitless reaching for the black can of paint on the ground. Nash sprayed a line of red through his piece in surprise. He gave a half-hearted chuckle in Daniel's direction and looked back at his tag disappointedly. Of course, he would mess up this time. Daniel cringed in embarrassment as Nash began altering his work slightly to accommodate for the accidental addition. He tightened his face uncomfortably and looked at his own tag. The lines were too thick. He should have known that this would be a lot different with spray paint. He looked at the black in his hand and put it back down in favor of the blue. He couldn't salvage the bird, that was for sure, but it'd be simple enough to turn it into something less detailed. The cacophony of the frogs and crickets rang louder in Daniel's ears now, having been reawakened to the voices of the night after breaking focus stepping on the can. Focus was something he'd been having trouble finding lately. His last semester in his drawing class had ended with probably a dozen or so unfinished drawings. He hadn't had the heart to finish any of the landscapes and had only done a couple of the portraits. Instead, after his teacher, Miss Galdonic, had introduced each week's project, he would return to his seat, pull out his encyclopedia of birds, and begin drawing whichever one suited his mood. The first had been a full front view of a shoebill, a long-legged bluish-gray creature with a tuft of feathers sticking up at the back of its head, and its loafer-like bill pointing down as if it were, at some point along its length, attached to the bird's neck. He had picked it for its stupidity, awestruck at the sheer audacity that the creature had to exist with such a form. Upon turning it in, Miss Galdonic had frowned in deep thought, and eventually raised her eyebrows and shrugged. Then she asked him to clear it with her before he undertook any more alternative projects. Tagging a bird here on the bridge now out of the question, Daniel glanced over at Nash, who was going at it with the red can. Daniel took the blue can in his hand and made two thick lines over his scarlet ibis, turning it into a squat X. For a while, he stared blankly at the thick lines. The two young men were quiet. Only the sound of spraying paint proved that they were under the bridge. Not knowing what else to do, he picked up the black and sprayed another thick line vertically through the center. He made the letters D and N on either side. D asterisk N. It was his gamer tag on the leaderboards at the arcade, whenever he would actually beat a record. Someone would always come along to shove him off, though, and he knew that would happen to this tag too someday. But it was simple enough for his first tag, and, like the arcade games, he could always come back and make his mark again. To make a better mark, or try to at least. He could really bullshit meaning into anything. How's this? He said to the frogs, putting his hand analytically to his non-existent whiskers. Nash took a step back from his own work, putting his hand similarly on his beard. Simple. Pretty nice. Needs a third color. There's got to be some sort of artsy rule for that, you know? Like good things come in threes. Oh, yeah. He picked up the green can, hoping that following Nash's advice would bring him into whatever wisdom he had that Daniel was missing. Blue for the first try, black to fix mistakes, green for the new beginning. A pretty basic meaning to write into cans of spray paint, to write into something that was just vandalism. They spent the rest of their time in silence, and when Daniel set down the white can, Nash looked over at his tag and gave an approving nod. The paint dripped in a number of places, but it wasn't about how good your tag was, just that it was yours. Nash finished up in the next few minutes. Daniel looked over the work, far more polished than his. It was a pretty good replica of one of the tags Nash had shown him earlier, but Nash had only called one of those his when he had pointed them out. The two on the abandoned building were similar in style and shape, and both were black and white with different accent colors. The one Nash had put here under the bridge was red where Daniel had expected green. Nash closed his eyes as if honoring the ceremony of vandalism and let the kid squirm for just a few more seconds. Nope, certainly nothing like his brother. The moment felt unclean. When Nash deemed that they had stood there a sufficient time, which could only really have been a few minutes, he gathered up the spray cans. Should really get you home, then. Good work. He casually sprayed a line of paint into the reeds. Yeah, it's pretty late. Daniel followed Nash up the embankment, and they made their way past the single streetlight and back into the neighborhood.
Hello, my name is Annie Zhang, and once again, I am the chief fiction editor and marketing director at the Tower. The next reader you'll hear from is Kang Zhang. Kang is an incoming freshman from Andover, Minnesota, looking to study English, film and theater, and creative writing. He is particularly interested in the ways in which animation and cinema intersect and how they can be merged through the form of language. Besides writing, he also enjoys spending time with his family and cousins. Kang will be reading an excerpt from the middle of his piece, A Portrait of Shinjuku. It begins focused on Mari, a young woman as she tends to her family's empty corner diner located in the middle of Shinjuku, Tokyo, during a typhoon. Her older brother, Asahi, dashes in, his suit and art portfolio wet from the rain. Their interactions are terse and awkward, underscored by their family separation, Mari's soon departure for America, and Asahi's insecure divorce from his love of art. We enter the scene as the two siblings stand out in the alleyway behind the diner, as Mari asks to look at Asahi's portfolio. Here is Kang Zhang reading an excerpt from A Portrait of Shinjuku.
Can I look? She says as she lifts the plastic. Asahi just shrugs and continues to scribble into his sketchpad. It was light, but his left hand clenches into a fist. She unzips a folder and sees a large piece of work. She unearths a large acrylic portrait of a woman with her hair of ivory red, the tag on the painting reads, Frame in Wildfire. It is colored in a rich purple and red, and in the middle, neon colors meld the canvas. But she can see it, the large buildings, the trains, and the way he has drawn it on the face of a woman. Hey, when did you draw this? She asks as she holds it up. He glances forward. Oh, I don't know, a while ago, he says. Dad wanted me to finish it for him. Who is it? What do you mean? The face. She looks familiar. I don't know what you're talking about. It reminds me of Dad's portrait. I pause. Put it away, Asahi says as he stops drawing. Let's not talk about it. Please. Mari places the portrait into the plastic and heads back into the restaurant. She forages the fridge and returns with two heated meat buns, the plastic still hot, and hands him one. As he takes the bun, she glances at his sketchpad. So, tell me more about the show, you know. What's it about? She says as she leans back. I thought you said you didn't want to come. I said I couldn't, not that I don't. She says as she pinches the soft skin of the dough. Well, it's my last show, so I'll just be watching. I'm not sure about the specifics, but I was able to print the set pieces and the playbill. Oh, by the way, do you still have Mom's pictures I asked for? I mean, is it here? Mari looks at him, his eyes lingering on his sketchpad. Mom? She asks. Yeah, I just placed them into a few boxes. Mari stares at Asahi, with the red hue of the tree outlines his head, until a flash of lightning crackles through the air and a single drop of water from the roof makes him flinch. He shivers in his thin clothes. Mari tosses him her meat bun. I'm getting cold, she says and heads back into the room. Grabbing the lantern on top of the desk, she lights a candle as he follows in behind her. She throws him a thin blanket and drops some cardboard boxes onto the ground. Many of them contain empty picture frames that were supposed to be hung on the bare walls of the restaurant. She kneels on the sleeping bag and sets the last box in front of her. Here's everything from the restaurant that Aunt packed away, she says as she takes the things out. Asahi sits across from her and touches the frames. She hands them to him, and when she gets to the bottom, she sees it. Hey, I think I found something, she says as she rips open the film of plastic. He moves towards her as she lifts the canvas from the large cardboard box. It spans the length of the desk. It looks like it had been in there for a long time. Asahi wipes the surface layered with dust. She knows as soon as she opens the film. It is a painting they used to hang on the wall, directly across from the window. The frame is lit with neon lights. She plugs the cord into the wall and the painting lights up. Its purple neon cuts across the room. The dark shadows in the corners there emblazoned with pink. It is the very first sign that had accompanied the restaurant, the sign they had helped their father create. Painting was of the city, of the way in which it became brighter when one looked further away. It was of their mother, a single figure amid Shinjuku, alone of the world. Asahi is quiet as he stares at the painting. On the sign there is a yellow sticky note, sprawled with handwriting. Their father's. Asahi puts his right hand into his pocket and leaves the room with his own portfolio. She hears him pacing before he throws it onto the floor. Mari snaps the post-it note from the paint, leaving a clean rectangle among the dust. She sits back and down and stares at the piece of paper. Mari had thought their mother had thrown away all of the paintings, but did she forget about this one? Asahi returns with his black suit jacket in his hand, the edges tearing at the seams. The residual paint smudged his hands. Asahi unplugs the cord and sits across from her, the light slowly fading. With a deep breath, he takes out his phone. She looks out the window above her and the wedge of musky light wandering through the opaque shades. It's like she can almost see the familiar picture as the phone in his hand reflects across his face. After a minute, he shoves it back into his pocket and closes his eyes. Asahi, Mari says as she crumbles a piece of paper. She looks at him, her eyes fully adjusted to the dark. Why did you come back? His body tenses. I thought you said you were leaving. With Mom. What do you mean? He says. You're leaving, so I thought you liked company. I pause. You don't have to stay, Asahi. He goes quiet as he needs his left arm. I'll be back, she says, but maybe not right away. She looks at his portfolio near the doorway and sighs deeply. I just need a break, you know? But you? Why did you quit? Why did you leave? You know how much Dad loved him when you painted? He bites his lip. I'm sorry, he whispers, but I can't do it, Mari. I haven't been able to. Mari takes the portrait from the table. I remember, she starts, how Dad smiled when you said you wanted to be like him. When we woke up every morning, the first in line, and you came home stuffing playbills into your box. When you first signed up for art school, she said, her voice shaking. When you didn't come back. Asahi closes his eyes. I'm not quitting, sis. I can't be the one who takes it. Aren't you the one leaving now? Mari places the painting into his hand, gazing at his face, a dark blur. She lightly puts her hand onto his left arm. He stops shaking. She grips his hand, looking at the portrait of Shinjuku. I'll always be with you, Asahi, she says, and though she is leaving, she really means it, though maybe it is a bit selfish to say it only to him. With a deep breath, she smiles, unwavering this time. Just be yourself. That will always be enough.
Hi there. My name is Claire Breitenbach, and I'm a fiction editor, art words judge, designer, and copy editor with The Tower. I'm here to introduce our next author. J.T. Cunningham is an undergraduate student from Minneapolis who will be receiving his B.A. in English this May. This piece explores the aftermath of a complicated relationship between a student and a teacher who don't always see eye to eye. I'm pleased to turn it over to J.T. Cunningham, reading A Boat Against the Shoreline, Oil on Canvas.
A boat against the shoreline. Oil on canvas. See what you're doing here? He pointed with a hairy finger at what was then my most recent painting. Using too much purple, I said. He glared at me behind his thick brown horn rims. Had this been even 40 years earlier, he would have smacked me good across the back of the head. Vandenberg was a traditionalist, a Puritan in all aspects of life, save for the three marriages that cost him a good deal of money on account of the divorce proceedings. He'd argue that this delineation from his typical miserly expenditures was out of his control, but his ex-wives would probably say otherwise. I understand what you're going for in terms of scope, he told me, but a seascape is not composed of a seascape. There are beaches and bluffs and boats. What do you have here, then? He enjoyed offering hypotheticals that weren't truly hypothetical, but rather a poor man's attempt at a parable. Often, I thought about asking him if he even knew what a rhetorical question was, but the singular instance where I corrected him on his definition of aphorism, he wouldn't let me paint on canvas for a week to teach me something about my intellectual snobbery and how far removed real art was from it. Yeah, I said. Yeah is not an answer to the question I posed. It's an idea, not an execution, I murmured. Precisely, he nodded. Maybe our styles just emulate completely different No, he snapped, the serpentine eyes telling me that he was itching to whack my wrist with the switch. No such thing. Art is art. Classifying oneself as belonging to one particular school only limits you. But you have to admit, I said, rubbing my wrists as if he actually hit it, my stuff doesn't fall into the Baroque tradition. And, he raised an eyebrow, Impressionism isn't about the fine details. And, the eyebrow rose higher, that's the movement my stuff more closely resembles? Damn it, have I taught you nothing? Vandenberg spat, hands now resting on his girthy hips. No classification, no categorization. We have those for a reason, I pointed out, to avoid situations like this entirely. Nonsense, he muttered, hands now folding into each other via his arms. I knew to convince him of seeing things my way bordered on impossible. He railed against the art history program every year, sending in petition after petition to have it liquidated into the history department, right up until his retirement 2 years after he graduated. Art history, he told me, amounted to nothing more than an excuse for the bourgeois to look down their noses at low art. When I asked him what that qualified as, he refused to answer, which meant he knew the paradox in his argument, and he indeed classified art between high and low forms, which meant qualification and categorization, which meant he was definitely a hypocrite. In his mind, I'm sure, he had worked through the mental gymnastics enough times to render the nonsensical as nothing more than painfully obvious. When I stare at my canvas now, I think about him and his rigid regulations for good art. I think about his refusal to admit defeat or accept concession, and my penchant to do the opposite. Perhaps because of this, we learned a great deal from each other, even if I was the only one to understand this. Primarily, we vehemently disagreed on the fundamental nature of art. See, to me, art is an expression of self, of one's psychology and philosophy and structures of belief. Art is not only one thing, nor one medium, nor even necessarily visual. It expands upon all things, a specter of the human consciousness on our external reality. To Vandenberg, art was exercise, mental and physical. Sketching and drawing, therefore, were vital steps to the act of creating. No spontaneity, none of that Caravaggio carving right on the canvas shit. It must be laborious just as it must be all-consuming. His marriages, as you can imagine, fell prey to an eternal war of the passion of art versus the love of people that, to a degree, all serious artists have. You don't need love to survive as a painter, he once told me. Just absinthe and yellow paint chips, I said. You think I'm joking. Even Van Gogh admitted love was a necessary component to living a full life, I pointed out. I imagine him alive and all he feels is loneliness.
It made him a better painter. Imagine if he hadn't felt all that. Would he have produced the works that he did?
Velázquez had a pretty stable personal life, I said.
And what do people admire him for? Vandenberg muttered. Ridiculous portraiture.
Vandenberg, though gifted to the nth degree with plenty of acclaim for his works, got himself blacklisted from the artistic community en masse for such blasphemy. A Philistine and a heretic, one fellow art professor called him in a paper just for the sin of thinking that Las Meninas was nothing more than a vanity project with no real worth, artistic or otherwise.
It says nothing, as it always has, and will continue to do so until the end of time, he was quoted as saying in a book on 17th century Spanish art. What about the dwarves? What about them?
When the author pointed out that there was a dwarf in Las Meninas, Vandenberg responded,
In, yes, but not the focus. That arrogant son of a bitch is. Him and that mustache.
Nevertheless, I never faulted him for it. I never much cared for Baroque art in the first place, and so had little to no opinion on the matter. Vandenberg, for all his flaws, was sincere. Though rigid, he was unpretentious. His love of art stemmed from a belief that art conveyed emotions and stories that were inert in other mediums, not because he wanted to impress anyone. If anything, I like to think that he would have hung up the smock if he received any attention that wasn't tinged with contempt. Meanwhile, I desperately craved it. Not from Vandenberg, since I knew I'd never get it, but from my fellow students, all of whom were fairly unimpressed. Nonplussed.
It's all right, I guess.
Yeah, it's fine.
Sure, I'd like it.
I never received a word of acclaim from them during my undergraduate years, nor did any of my paintings make it into the student magazine. Some of my fellow art undergrads got their works hung up in lobbies and the library. Eventually, some got into the galleries. Mine typically ended up at the bottom of trash cans. For a time, I tried following Vandenberg's examples and their concrete rationality, their narrow concentration on the fine details. I even tried a version of the painting where I did exactly as he told me to do. But I couldn't. It wasn't me. And as much as we disagreed on the subject, I knew that betraying my own ideas for the sake of approval would be far worse a disappointment for him than my continued insolence. Needless to say, I'm not a professional. Almost none of my fellow undergrads are either, save for a few who wised up and started making weird installation art that still doesn't make sense to me. In his last email to me, Vandenberg bemoaned the state of the art world as a barren wasteland disguised as intellectual curiosity. I have to laugh because to Vandenberg, every art movement, even the ones he subconsciously emulated, could be described as such. Weirdly enough, as I've been told by other people who knew him, I was one of his favorite students. Over his 50-odd years as an art instructor, Vandenberg fell into a cycle about every 5 years or so. He'd sniff out talent and try his best to nurture it before said talent inevitably floundered because of excessively lofty ambition or a lack of dedication or some other excuse he conjured up to avoid wasting any more emotional effort on them. Then they'd be cut loose, nothing more than ripped pages of a sketchbook in the wind, and he turned to what he hoped would be the genuine article. As you can imagine, he never found it. But being one of his favorites, so to speak, meant he didn't blame me for my lack of professional success. Sometimes he boiled it down to, as he put it, plain bad luck, and with those students he kept in periodic contact, an email here and there about a new gallery showing or an exhibit at a museum. It was nothing personal, nothing warm or friendly, but just to be on his mailing list meant you managed not to disappoint him. With him, that had to be enough. Long after our correspondence faded into the impersonal and perfunctory, I decided to replicate the painting I did with him that one day, the one with too much purple. It's not the original, because I ruined that one by fine-tuning the lines to emulate someone else's style. Instead, this one is mine and mine alone, including all of the excess purple. It's just a seascape, but with a beach and a bluff and a boat. I didn't understand the point of the boat until I think halfway through painting it. It's merely a component, one that isn't even essential to the final piece, but it doesn't have to be anything, essential or otherwise. It just has to be present. Present and full of a vigor that you wish everybody else had. And I think that's why he put up with me. We both had it, even when everybody else told us we shouldn't. In the end, it really is just a boat. But to us, that's all it has to be.
Hello, it's Shay again, fiction editor and online editor for The Tower. I'm here to introduce our final reader, Megan Lang. Megan is a junior from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, studying technical and creative writing. She writes every single day and plans to pursue an MFA in creative writing after graduation. Her work has been published in The Tower previously, and we're delighted to feature two more of her pieces this year. Megan will be reading her piece, A Long Day at the Theater. This piece documents the mundane events and inner thoughts of a former theater actress who experiences memory loss and confusion of reality. With just the right blend of vagueness and clarity that keeps readers on their toes, this piece shines in its subtle details. Here is Megan Lang reading A Long Day at the Theater.
A Long Day at the Theater. Sometimes, the days feel shorter than they are long, and I am in the unfortunate position of having to determine for myself and my family which it is, a short day or a long one. Calvin encourages me not to worry so much about this, but it's difficult not to worry about something as important as the length of a day. When I was a girl, I liked to go to the theater. So when I was a woman, I became an actress. I could play anything. The directors told me I had the perfect face, the perfect voice. I could be anyone. I could metamorphose. I could become whatever I wished to be. I met Calvin in the theater. I was 18 and he was 25, the director of a small play his friend wrote. I didn't believe he was 25 when he told me that he was, and he didn't believe me when I told him I was 18. It's a short one, I told him sadly, sitting in front of the bay window and watching the birds outside on the feeders. He hummed, setting down his newspaper. Every day is long, he said. He sounded grumpy, like he was upset with me. I started to cry, and he didn't like that. He stood up and began to shout at me, but I was already in the throes of it. Each tear made the day last a little longer. My last day on stage was when I was 23. I was pregnant, and Calvin and I were soon to be married, and I couldn't very well be trouncing around on stage every day with a baby on my hip. Those last days in the theater were woefully short. Calvin and I were married, and he got a job at the cannery in town with other men. These men had rough hands when I shook them at company parties. These men had known nothing but work since they could tie their shoes. Calvin hated real work. Every day dragged on for him longer and longer than the one before. Tomorrow was going to be enough, Calvin said, and pounded a fist on the table. His hands were rough now, not like when we were married. Years in the cannery made him strong, carved him into one of those hard-working men. Enough about the days, Pamela, enough! The next time you talk about the days... I stopped listening to him right about then and started to focus on the tablecloth. Margaret Marie was the baby's name, or it would have been, but she was stillborn. That day was the longest of them all. We painted her room that same shade of mint green as the tablecloth. I think she was stillborn. Or maybe a woman I played in a play had a stillborn baby. Maybe she was alive and well with children of her own. Maybe I'd wanted her to be stillborn. I sat in my nightdress all day because I knew it was supposed to be a short one. Calvin asked me to please get dressed, but I told him a mother in mourning needs to do what she needs to do. It takes time to collect herself after such a tragedy. Who knew a bike accident could be so tragic? Margie was only 6 when she crashed her bike off a rail bridge and into a pond. She hit her head on a stone and floated down the river, never to be seen again. My costume for that show was a nightdress made of crisp white fabric and smelled like it had been in some old lady's closet for months or years before the costume designer left it hanging in my dressing room. I was working on a painting of a little green bicycle in the drawing room later that afternoon. I was a far better actress than I was a painter, and my hands ached with the little strokes. My hands were strange these days. They looked stippled with makeup, dark spots and wrinkles lining them, bones shadowed to look gaunter and more apparent for the audience. The phone rang. "Calvin, dear, can you answer that, please? I'm not feeling well." I called out to him as if he were in another room, but he was standing by the window, lost in thought. On the stage, you call out to someone, even if they're only a few feet away, to show the audience there's space between you. Calvin sighed and took the phone off the hook. "Hello, Mags," he said. He kept his voice low like he didn't want me to hear him, but I heard him very well. "No, she isn't. I don't think you should bring the boys by today." I couldn't hear the woman on the other end, but that name was familiar. I wonder if she was from the Acting Guild. I didn't like the idea of playing an old woman, but if I didn't have to audition, it might be fun. The theater was so distant. I missed it terribly. "Tell her I'll do it," I said, waving my paintbrush at Calvin, "but don't make me sound desperate." He sighed. "We'll talk later. All right. We love you. Tell the boys we love them, too. Say hi to Bill." Calvin's lips curled in distaste at that name, and I wondered who he was. A stubborn actor, no doubt. Directors hate stubborn actors. Calvin never did get along well with his actors. Except for me, of course. I didn't wear black to Maggie's funeral because I knew she would have wanted everyone to be wearing happy colors. We held black umbrellas even though it wasn't raining. We wanted everyone to look and think that it was raining because that made the whole affair so much sadder. The pastel green of my dress made my blue eyes bright even from the back row. I tried not to look sad like a mother in mourning, but happy like a woman in love. People gave me looks. They didn't understand I was only doing what Margie would have wanted. They gave me nasty looks because I was a star, and they weren't. Eventually, that long day came to an end. While we were lying in bed, I rolled over to watch Calvin. He was still awake, staring at the ceiling. "Calvin?" "Yes, dear," He sounded tired. Why wasn't he sleeping? When I die, I said, my voice so quiet I almost couldn't hear it. Bury me next to Maggie, will you? He opened his mouth like he had a lot of things he wanted to say to that, like he was just boiling over with words for me, but then he closed it again. Resigned. Defeated. Okay, dear. He rolled over so I couldn't see him anymore. I sniffled and whimpered all night, wishing for my baby, wondering vaguely at the pretty woman in the picture on my nightstand. She looked a bit like me, but she wasn't. She had two little boys at her side and a man that was not handsome enough for her. So unfortunate when a leading man could not meet the quality of the leading lady. I stared at the photo for hours, even minutes, and hoped that the lady never knew what it was like to lose a child.
Thank you all for listening to the Towers 14th edition launch as a podcast presentation. My name is Anne. I am a managing editor along with Bailey and Afton, who you will hear in just a moment. As you may know by now, the Tower Art and Literary Magazine started in 1952 as a column in the Minnesota Daily. Today, we are a class of 19 students running the magazine with the help of an English faculty advisor, Dr. Selar. Every year, we ask for student submissions in the fall, then compile a themed magazine in the spring. We are happy to present the 2020 edition of the Art and Literary Magazine. Please visit our website to see the newest edition available online at thetower.umn.edu, which will be released at the end of April 2020. Our physical copies are sure to be available and free to all once campus is reopened.
Thanks for that explanation, Anne. As for everyone else, hi, I'm Bailey, another managing editor, in addition to being a copy editor and nonfiction editor for The Tower. At this time, we would like to sincerely thank the Minnesota Daily, The Wake Magazine, Fuse, or the Fellowship of Undergraduate Students in English, and Radio K for helping us get the word out for submissions every fall and for advertising the launch party each spring. We would also like to extend our appreciation to Chipotle and Blaze Pizza for their fundraising partnerships. We also thank our contributors, families, and friends of the Tower, and our professor and supervisor, Dr. Selar. We sincerely thank the business groups, without whom the creative work of the magazine would not be possible. This includes the copy editors, designers, developmental directors, publicists, marketing directors, managing editors, and our editors-in-chief. Afton will now explain the work these groups did in more detail.
Hello, everyone. My name is Afton, and I'm a managing editor, the chief poetry editor, and an ArtWords judge here at The Tower. Thank you for listening. Throughout these podcasts, you have heard from each of our incredible team members, all in different genres, including art, ArtWords, poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. Every person on The Tower plays at least two crucial roles between genre and business categories, and many have three or more. Please listen carefully to each person's introduction and feel free to reach out to us if you'd like to learn more about what working in these roles on The Tower is like. Although I can confidently say one answer across the board will be fun. I'd like to take the time to thank the staff of The Tower for all of their hard work, from producing a literary magazine to creating this podcast. Working on a dedicated team of 20 people has been exhilarating, and I appreciate the time, patience, and effort that went into this year's edition. Our editors-in-chief, Lauren and Kate, have guided the team's thematic vision of this year's magazine from the very beginning. My co-managing editors, Ann and Bailey, have helped me to organize and create this podcast, collaborate with other business teams and genres, and to keep everyone on our production schedule throughout the year. Our online editors, Maddie and Shay, have done some amazing campaigns and blogs on our website and social media. Our marketing directors, Mickey and Annie, have guided our publicists, Riley, Jess, Maggie, and Kimberly, to perform an amazing amount of outreach and partnership with local businesses such as Radio K, The Wake Magazine, Minnesota Daily, Chipotle, Blaze Pizza, and so many more. Our development directors, Swetha and Haley, have worked closely with student unions and activities and the Minnesota Student Association to raise funds and make publication possible. Our design managers, Sarah and Chandra, have led the design team of Jacob, Maddie, Riley, and Claire to visual perfection on everything from flyers to the margins of our magazine, while our copy editors, Bailey, Claire, Haley, Jess, Swetha, and our head copy editor, Maggie, have followed up over and over to make sure everything we produce is nothing short of sheer perfection. Finally, I'd like to thank our director and professor, Dr. Jim Selar, for giving us the opportunity to work on this amazing team, which has been a once-in-a-lifetime experience. This podcast would not be possible without the help of Ryan Hayes, who guided every step from audio recording to editing, and who created our fabulous intro music. You can find him on SoundCloud and Twitter at DJHayesMPLS. I'd also like to extend my thanks to Jamie Young and the Weissman Art Museum, who collaborate in partnership with the Tower, from publicity to hosting our launch party. Despite the party being canceled in the face of COVID-19, Jamie and the Weissman have worked twice as hard and have been nothing but a pleasure. I'd also like to thank our ArtWords guest judges, Michael Curran from the Weissman Art Museum, Professor Douglas Kearney from the University of Minnesota's Department of English, and Sam Van Cook, the founder of Button Poetry. And, of course, the Tower would not be possible without readers, listeners, and contributors like you. Thank you.